All right, good evening. Let's go ahead and get started. Welcome to tonight's meeting of the Northern Regional Advisory Council. My name is John Cavett, and I'm the vice chair, and I'm going to be taking over for Robert Burns, who isn't able to join us tonight, who's our chair. I'd like to start off by asking the council to introduce themselves, and we'll start over at the far end over there.
Lynn Nelson from Cache County.
John Wall from Riverdale, represent public at large.
John Leonard, North Ogden, representing sportsmen.
John Blazard from Camas, representing agriculture.
Craig Van Tassel from Camas, sportsman.
Paul Cowley, representing the Forest Service.
Jim Gaskill from South Weaver at large.
Russ Lawrence from Ogden at large.
Bryce Thurgood Perry at large.
R. Jeffrey Hicks at large.
Kristen Purdy from Ogden, non-consumptive.
And I'm Justin Doling. I'm the regional supervisor for the Division of Wildlife, and I act as the executive secretary, and I'm a non-voting member.
Okay, thank you. I'd like to welcome and recognize Bill Fenimore, who's a Wildlife Board member, present tonight. If I could remind everyone to turn off their cell phones so that we can have a uninterrupted meeting tonight, that would be very much appreciated. The purpose of the Regional Advisory Council is to gather input from the public concerning wildlife management, policy, rules, and regulations. The council then makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board. The Wildlife Board considers the recommendations from the five Regional Advisory Council and sets policy for all protected species in Utah. This meeting will be recorded for the transcription of the minutes of this meeting, and the audio recording and minutes will be available on the DWR website. When you speak, please use the microphones and speak clearly so that it can be accurately transcribed. All right, so I'd like to go ahead and proceed to the agenda. We'd like to have an approval or a motion for approval of the minutes from the last meeting. You should have received the email of those. Robert indicated that there were no emails concerning any corrections or additions, but we can take a motion if there is one.
Or move to approve the minutes.
Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. Announce. Paul Cowley. Sorry. The Wildlife Board meeting update, Robert indicated that he provided the information to everyone, and that if you have any specific questions about the Wildlife Board last meeting, that you can certainly email him, and he'd be happy to correspond with you regarding that. Okay, regional update.
Okay, looks like we've got a real packed audience here, so I'll try to make this entertaining as possible. So for our regional update, I just wanted to go through and let you know some of the things that are happening in our different sections here in the region. So starting with outreach, we have our Tundra Swan Day that's coming up March 14th, and that'll be held at Salt Creek from 9 to 3. So if you enjoy seeing tundra swans, I encourage you to get on up to Salt Creek and take a look. They are starting to move out a little bit early, so hopefully we have some swans there to look at. The other thing is the fly fishing film tour is again being held here in Ogden. I believe this is the third annual, and it'll be at the Egyptian Theater on the 6th of March, and it'll start at 6 p.m. So if you're a fly fishing aficionado, it's got some really, it's kind of like a Warren Miller type fly fishing event. In our habitat section, we're working on submitting new projects for funding consideration. We're going through our funding cycle and hopefully get some of those projects approved here in the region. And then we're currently still working on a couple of large bull hog projects for a juniper removal project out in West Box Elder, and that's focusing primarily in the Grouse Creek area and then also in Park Valley. In our wildlife section, we're just putting the final touches on our Bucks, Bulls, and once-in-a-lifetime permit recommendations. You'll be seeing that in April. And then the guys are gearing up for sharp-tailed grouse and sage-grouse counts, the elect counts that will be happening here about the 15th of March. If you have an interest in coming out and joining one of the biologists on elect counts, Randy Wood would be your best contact, or you can contact me and I can direct you in the right direction. In our wildlife section, wanted everybody to know that Val Bachman has decided to retire. His last day will be March 15th. So after about almost a 37-year career, we're letting Val go. So he'll be heading up to Idaho and spending some time up in Idaho.
Are you sure it's not 137?
In our administrative service section, they just had a couple of updates, and the first being that our big game application process for the actual application ends March 5th, and if you miss that March 5th deadline and still want to get a bonus point, you can do that up until March 12th. In our law enforcement section, we have one new individual that promoted since our last meeting, and Wyatt Buback, who was the Davis County Conservation Officer, is now the sergeant for Weber Davis. So we're excited to have Wyatt there, and we now have one CO vacancy in Davis County, and hopefully we can get that filled shortly. In our aquatic section, don't know how much you guys know about bluehead sucker. It's kind of a species of concern, lives within the Weber River drainage, and the guys are going to go up and do some salvage between Rockport Reservoir and Echo Reservoir. There's a very small population of bluehead sucker that live within that reach of the stream, and because the temperatures are so low, their reproductive capabilities are almost non-existent. So the plan is to capture those fish and move them down below Echo Reservoir to augment the more healthier populations below Echo. And then there'll be a Friends of Willard Bay open house in Brigham City at the county courthouse March 5th, and that'll be from 7 to 9. They're trying to generate some interest in the Friends of Willard Bay, so I encourage everybody to come out if you've got an interest in joining that Friends group. And that's all I have, unless there's questions. Go ahead, Bryce.
I was down at the expo, and one of the guys was talking about the deer transplant in Bountiful. He said that they had pretty good luck and success. Do you have any info on that?
Yeah, I can give you a little update on that. That's been an extremely successful project. We've been trapping and moving deer out of Bountiful for about 2 months now, and we're just a little over 200 deer that have been trapped and moved, and about half of those deer have been translocated out into the Uinta Basin out by Mighton. I believe it's called Big Wash. And then the other half have gone out to the Raft River Mountains out in Box Elder County. So it's been an extremely successful project, and Channing Howard has kind of led that effort in our region.
Have they had a pretty, because I know you're calling them, but they had a pretty successful, survivor?
She's just in the process. We put collars on all the adults. We didn't collar the fawns, but she's just in the process of scheduling flights to get up in the air and be able to monitor survival. So we should have some information by the April meeting as to what kind of survival we've had so far.
Cool.
But and the deer in Bountiful were in extremely good condition. No, go ahead.
I got a question about the Snow Goose Festival and the Snow Goose Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
Did you get a little updates on that? How'd that go? And then and how is the Snow Goose opener? Have hunters been having success? Or
okay, I can give you a little update there. The division unfortunately scheduled the Snow Goose Festival and the opening day of the Snow Goose Hunt in the Delta area on the same day, and so the decision was made to actually postpone the hunt for 2 days. So the festival was, I believe, Friday and Saturday, and then the hunt opened on Monday. And the report I had was it was fairly slow. The hunt up here in the northern part of the state has been open now for at least a week. And without those new birds that are arriving from the south, it's been also pretty slow. But we anticipate with that activity in Delta that they'll start to push a few more birds up north.
Okay, thank you, Justin. Just in case Robert reads the minutes, I guess I ought to go through the meeting procedures that he gave me. The meeting will proceed as follows. A representative of the Division of Wildlife Resources will make the presentation on the agenda item. Then we will have questions from the public on the presentation. And this time is for questions only, not comments. Next, we will have then the questions from the council. And then we will take comments from the public on the agenda items. If you wish to make a comment regarding the agenda item, we would ask that you fill in a blue comment card. And those individuals representing themselves will have 3 minutes, and groups will have 5 minutes. Okie doke. So let's go ahead and begin with our first agenda item here on the Utah Prairie Dog Management Plan. And we have Marty Bushman to present the proposal, the plan.
Thank you. I don't know if all of you know me. My name is Marty Bushman. I'm an assistant attorney general with the state of Utah, but I'm assigned to the Division of Wildlife Resources. Although an employee of the attorney general's office, I'm kind of owned by DWR. So I come here today to give you a little bit of information on the Prairie Dog Management Plan. So by way of background, this is a plan that's been put together as a result of a judicial decision out of the Federal District Court of Utah, which I'll tell you a little bit more in a second. But it was as a result of trying to bring together a large number of folks to put together a plan. This was all compressed in a fairly short time frame in that the decision came down in November, which was a good time because prairie dogs were underground by and large, although this winter they've been a little confused and above ground in February and January, but it gave us time through the winter to put this plan together and have something in place by the time prairie dogs emerged. And so as a result, we have 5 RAC meetings going on tonight, the same night, and you guys drew the short straw. You got the lawyer to come up here and tell you a little bit about it, and I've been involved in the planning process and writing the rule, and so hopefully I can give you the information you need and we can move forward. So let's begin with the judicial decision. On November 4th, last fall, an organization called People for the Ethical Treatment of Property Owners filed suit against the United States Fish and Wildlife Service. Now, the suit was filed earlier, but on November 5th, Judge Benson from the Federal District Court for the District of Utah entered a decision where he vacated the Fish and Wildlife Service's authority to regulate the take of prairie dogs on non-federal lands. And just to give you a little more background of this is, the federal government, anytime it attempts to regulate a matter that's otherwise an authority of the state, such as wildlife management, it has to have an enumerated power in the Constitution. And in the Endangered Species Act, what has been relied upon since its inception is the Commerce Clause, feeling that these species cross state lines, many of them are involved in commerce, and they implicate interstate commerce, therefore the federal government through Congress has authority to regulate the take. Well, the argument was made with the Utah prairie dog that it is an intrastate species, it occurs only in Utah, and has never had any market value whatsoever, and therefore there is no implication of the interstate commerce cause. This argument's been made before a lot of other federal circuits. None have been persuaded, but Judge Benson in this case was. And he held that as a result that the prairie dog here in Utah didn't implicate interstate commerce, Congress did not have the authority through the Endangered Species Act to regulate the take of it, nor did the Fish and Wildlife Service more explicitly have authority to implement regulations that would specify under what circumstances take could be held. So as it stands, The state, since November 5th, has had management authority over prairie dogs on non-federal lands. So let me give you a little background on the prairie dog. The Utah prairie dog is one of five species in North America. There's a whitetail, blacktail, Gunnison, and Mexican prairie dog. This particular species here, the Utah prairie dog, exists only in southwestern Utah. And if you look at this map, and the colors I won't, you know, tell you too much about, other than that the purple color there in the southwest corner of Utah is the range of the Utah prairie dog. The species was first listed as an endangered species in 1973, where they had about 3,000 individuals, they believed, and it had some fairly significant population declines over the previous years. Its historic range, as you can see on this map here, the kind of the pink area includes its historic range. The blue areas include or document where it occurs currently today. In 1984, the Utah prairie dog was downlisted to threatened, which gave the Fish and Wildlife Service a little bit more ability and flexibility in authorizing take. And for those not familiar with it, the prairie dog has created considerable problems in southern Utah. It seems to occupy the same lands that farmers like, the same types of soils, and also many of the fertile valley soils where cities are. So we have prairie dogs in cemeteries, in golf courses, in backyards, airports, and a whole host of other places that have caused a great deal of problem. And it's been a constant trial for these folks in southern Utah trying to deal with them in these nuisance areas while at the same time trying to protect them under the Endangered Species Act. So approximately 70% or 16,000 adults of these Utah prairie dogs occur on non-federal unprotected lands. And I'll give you that term protected. Is protected lands are lands that there is some type of legal document, whether it's a conservation easement, maybe it's a fee title conveyance, where it is preserved and protected for the benefit of prairie dogs in perpetuity. So when we speak of protected lands, we're talking about lands that could be either federal, state, private, but it means they've got some mechanism built within that protects them for prairie dog habitat. Prairie dogs gravitate to the sage steppe habitat, and their diet consists mainly of grasses and forbs. They like alfalfa, I'm told. Ranchers say that's a big food source for those that get into the fields. They produce about 1 litter a year with an average litter size of 4 individuals. So by way of the management history of the species, some of the management actions that we've had in the past are we do spring counts, translocations from places where they are causing trouble, such as cemeteries or golf courses, and translocating them to areas where they're not going to have conflicts with humans. And then lastly, issuing control permits for the removal of prairie dogs. Now, over the years that the species has been listed, there's been a number of habitat conservation plans, 5 to be exact. There was a habitat conservation plan for Iron County in 1998. There's a low effect HCP for Iron and Garfield County, which was just recent. There's an HCP for the golf course in Cedar City, and then the Paiute Indian Tribe as well has one. And these were the mechanisms under the Endangered Species Act by which residents in Utah could try to deal with Utah prairie dogs that were causing conflicts on their lands. The HCPs were the mechanism for getting incidental take permits. Now, there has been a Utah prairie dog recovery plan that was just revised, I believe, in 2012. And it has established some goals that were necessary for recovery. And one was that there'd be 1,000 counted adults on public and protected lands in each of the 3 recovery areas. So there are 3 distinct recovery areas within southwestern Utah. There's the West Desert, which includes mostly Iron County. There's the Paunsagunt, which is primarily Garfield County, and then there's the Awapa Plateau, which is Wayne County, and a few of those areas overlap in small part in some other counties. And so the goal was to have 1,000 prairie dogs in each one of those units for 3 years, and then to have 5,000 protected occupied acres of habitat. for each of the three recovery areas. And those were the goals that were being pushed forward and moving towards prior to the November 5th decision by Judge Benson. So this is the proposed plan. Now that the state has authority to manage prairie dogs, it began, I say, with a consortium of many people and groups that had interest in this. I won't go through and read them all. But the plan, we had several meetings over the last 2 months where folks got together. We came up with ideas and ways, objectives and goals that were going to be achieved, and brought this forward. Now the plan, so you know, is designed so that every year it's reevaluated and, if necessary, can be amended. If we see that prairie dog population numbers increasing, that can be amended to perhaps allow more take in certain areas. If population numbers are declining faster than we think, then it can be amended to curtail take. So the main goal of the plan was to remove restrictions from the private property through a timely and structured process while assisting in the conservation of populations on designated federal and protected non-federal lands. Those were the two things: protect property rights to the extent we could, protect the species. So one of the overarching objectives was to develop a cooperative education and information program. And this was going to be a joint program between DWR and the counties to develop online education and permitting processes to give folks information about where prairie dogs can be taken and under what circumstances and when they cannot, and to get the information out and educate people so that we have the minimum number of folks taking prairie dogs illegally because they just didn't realize it was illegal to begin with. And at the beginning of spring of 2015, DWR will coordinate a series of outreach programs and campaigns to try to get this information out. Now, to really understand this scheme, you got to kind of understand the landscape. And prairie dogs have been mapped since about 1972, wherever prairie dogs have been observed, they've been put down on a map as being occupied habitat. And so the first lands I want to talk a little bit are lands that are unmapped, meaning lands and where prairie dogs have never been observed before, or where they haven't been observed for 5 consecutive years. So these are lands that don't currently have prairie dogs, and it has one of the more liberal take provisions on those types of lands. Properties that are not mapped as of 2014 are exempt. In other words, they won't be mapped if a prairie dog happens to wander onto it. And these unoccupied and unmapped territories, individuals can take the prairie dogs, the property owner, their immediate family, a lessee, their immediate family, or an employee, can take prairie dogs on their property. They have to provide notification to the division that they're going to do it. They have to provide an annual report of how many prairie dogs they take. And so it's fairly wide open, although it's not believed that this will have a large impact on prairie dogs. We just don't believe there's many prairie dogs on these unmapped, unoccupied areas. By definition, there's not supposed to be prairie dogs there. Further, DWR will maintain a database of the mapped and unmapped and occupied and unoccupied areas so individuals can be able to determine where their land lies. So to kind of get an example of what's happened with this new change, if you look at the map on your right, the purple marked areas are mapped occupied habitat. Those are the areas where there's going to be a greater level of protection for prairie dogs. Everything outside of the purple areas is the more liberal provisions, which I just explained to you. And to kind of understand the difference between what we have now versus what was in place with the Fish and Wildlife Service, the map on the left shows where the Fish and Wildlife Service considered any, you know, surface disturbing activities in those areas as a take and it had to be mitigated. But these were all based off buffers where you may have had areas that were actually mapped and then you had areas around them that were buffers that they were protecting as well. And so through this process, there's been about 51,000 acres in Cedar City, Enoch area that have been freed up now and would be considered unmapped as opposed to mapped with mitigation responsibilities if you do any surface disturbing activities. Now, within mapped areas, now we're going to talk just about those where prairie dogs have actually been observed. There's a number of categories that we will deal with. One is developed areas where we have houses and parks and communities and cities and airports, golf courses, recreation areas, fields, and schools. Within there will be a provision for the take of prairie dogs under health, safety, and welfare for the public, where a landowner, again, if they have a prairie dog in their yard or if the city has a prairie dog in their park, upon providing notice to the Division of Wildlife Resources, they can remove that prairie dog. Now, they have to do it by a means that's lawful. In other words, it's not prohibited by city or local ordinance. And they can't hire people to come and do it, although there is one exception. The county sheriff and city police officers can receive certificates of registration from the division to remove prairie dogs for other individuals within the cities and communities for health, safety, and welfare purposes. Also within that health, safety, and welfare category is instances are within 50 feet of a occupied structure, so another a home, a business, hotel, commercial enterprise, where people actually live. Those owners can remove prairie dogs within 50 feet of that structure, as long as it's on their own land. And they can remove prairie dogs in the curtilage, a larger area, if it's a landscaped, improved area, you know, along their driveways and so forth. If it's areas that, like I say, are improved and used by the folks that live there. So these can be all removed without a permit. Prior notification is required. And the number of prairie dogs taken needs to be reported to the division. Now, the division's also going to do target trapping in these instances where, when they get called and notified, if it looks like it would be productive to come and trap, they will try to live trap those prairie dogs and relocate them to areas where they're establishing new colonies and on protected lands and areas where there'll be no conflict with human beings. Now, the next category lands are what I'm going to call are developable lands, meaning lands that have no current structures on them, but they are zoned for commercial, residential, or industrial development. And agricultural lands and range lands. Agriculture lands mean lands that are zoned for agriculture use, where there is a cultivated crop planted or irrigated, or an irrigated pasture that's either grazed or harvested. Those are agricultural lands. Range lands are lands that are used primarily for grazing, and those that are not agriculture are not cultivated or irrigated. So in these three categories, there's going to be a range-wide limit on the number of prairie dogs that can be taken every year, and that's 6,000 individuals. This number comes from the 4D rule that the Fish and Wildlife Service developed in trying to recover the prairie dog. It applied only to agriculture lands. This take will apply to all three categories of those lands, meaning that there'll be no number of prairie dogs that can be taken beyond the 6,000. Now, there can be an additional number added to that 6,000 if the adult count on all non-federal lands that aren't protected is 6,000 individuals. If it's over 6,000, half that number over 6,000 will get added to the 6,000 limit. I know it's a little confusing because we're using that 6,000 twice, but it will be based on that we have that number can go up based on the number of prairie dogs that are on these private lands. Now, prairie dogs taken for health, safety, and welfare will not be deducted, you know, from that range-wide limit. Prairie dogs that are trapped and relocated will not be deducted. And as I said before, the range-wide limit will be applied to developable agriculture and rangelands. So let's talk about developable lands. I explained those before. Those are just lands that are within an area that has been zoned commercial, industrial, or residential, and which there are no structures. But the process for that is an individual desiring to remove prairie dogs or to, you know, destroy habitat, so to speak, by building a structure. They have to go to the city for a permit. They will then have to come to the division and make a request to take the prairie dogs or to do that. The division will then go out and survey the property and determine whether prairie dogs are there or not. If no prairie dogs are there, they'll be given an immediate clearance letter to proceed. If prairie dogs are discovered on the property, The division will work with the proponent of the project to try to trap prairie dogs where it's feasible and advisable, and to remove them before any type of construction activities are performed. And once that's done, then the proponent of the project would be given a certificate of registration to proceed with the project. And here we'll know the number of prairie dogs that will actually be lost, because those that we've counted, you know, subtracting those that are trapped and relocated, we'll be able to figure that out pretty easily. So there's no reporting requirement on this, since it kind of it's determined at the front end. The big thing here, which was a huge issue for Southern Utah, and that is mitigation fees. And so here you'll see that there will be no mitigation fees charged for development or projects that are committed. Now, it's kind of funny, because it was only $1,000 per acre. And in talking with the Fish and Wildlife Service, they initially thought that sounded rather radical, but then they said, well, it was only like $7,000 or $8,000 a year. It wasn't really doing much in terms of buying any new property or protecting any new property. And one of the things we're working on now is there's a bill in the legislature right now, or at least a funding or appropriation for $600,000 to help provide additional funding to run this program, to trap more prairie dogs, relocate them, to buy lands, and to also fund a compensation program. I'll tell you in just a second. So agriculture and rangelands. The objective here was to alleviate impacts that prairie dogs have on these lands. And they come in two forms. One is prairie dogs actually eat the cultivated crops and destroy some of the production of those properties. And the other one is the mounds and mounds of dirt that they push up around their burrow systems are difficult on swathers and other farm equipment as they go through them, trying to cut hay and harvest crops. So again, with this one, there will be a range-wide limit of 6,000 individuals. And then on these lands, because it's where most of the prairie dogs occur, is on these agricultural and range lands, there will also be an individual limit applied to the property itself. And it's going to be based on the number of prairie dogs on that property and the number of prairie dogs in the recovery unit. There's a little table I'll show you in this next slide that kind of explains how that's done. So individuals will be able to get a lethal take permit to remove prairie dogs, and prairie dogs that are trapped under this system, live trapped, are not deducted from the range-wide 6,000 individual limit. So here's how it works. If you're a property owner and the division goes out and counts 100 prairie dogs on your property, and you then go to the recovery unit that this particular property is in, and if there are 0 to 999 prairie dogs in the recovery unit, then 50% of the productivity of the animals on the property can be taken. And then if it's recovery unit count is between 1,000 to 1,249, 100% of the productivity can be taken. And you can see from there, as the number of prairie dogs go up on the recovery unit, and they're all got to be on protected lands, meaning those are lands that should not have any conflicts anymore with prairie dogs and people, then the number of prairie dogs, or the percentage of prairie dogs on the individual landowner's property, goes up that they can take. Once we hit 2,000 individuals on the recovery unit, then all limits are removed. No CORs are required. We've essentially reached recovery goals at that point. And what it will mean is we've now got 2,000 individuals on protected property that we should not be having any conflicts and should be self-sustaining. So if we were to do a quick example, if the spring count on an individual's property were 75, and here's how the equation would work out in trying to determine the number of prairie dogs that can be taken. So first step would be is take the 75 prairie dogs, that's the count that was observed above ground, multiply that by 2, since models tell us that only about 50% of the prairie dogs are above ground at any one time, so double that, then times it by 0.67 to try to determine percent females, multiply that by 0.97% of breeding females, and multiply that by 4, which is the average litter size, and that equals 390, which is the productivity of it. Step two is we'd go to the table. If the three-year average on the protected lands in the recovery unit is 626, then calculated take would be 50% of the productivity, which would be 195 prairie dogs.
Wow.
Got it? Now, within agricultural lands, there's also going to be a voluntary incentive program. So agricultural lands that have greater than 50 prairie dogs on their spring count may participate in a compensation program where if the landowner agrees to forego lethal take of prairie dogs on their land and allow the division to come in and trap prairie dogs, and we're really looking between July 1st and September 30th because that's when prairie dogs are the most mature and have the greatest level of survivability on translocation. If individuals will allow that to happen without using lethal means to kill them, the division will compensate them for the period of time that we were trying to trap prairie dogs. And the formula is all based off, you know, how much alfalfa an adult prairie dog eats over a five-month period, how much alfalfa a juvenile eats over a four-month period, since they're not above ground as long as the adults. And calculating those figures by the number of prairie dogs on the property, and then adding an additional 10% for compensation that would be really focused on trying to deal with equipment damage that might have resulted from the prairie dogs being there. So it'll be a set formula based on how many prairie dogs are on the property. The landowner doesn't have to do it, but if they agree to and we pay them, the trapped prairie dogs do count against both the property limit and the range-wide limit. If landowners, on the other hand, agree to forego lethal take without compensation and allow us to trap, those prairie dogs don't count against the 6,000 range-wide limit or the individual property limit. And one is just trying to reward landowners that are willing to allow us to trap and relocate without being compensated. So now to federal and protected lands. I first remember is on federal lands, the prairie dog is still fully listed under the Endangered Species Act. So state has no authority over the prairie dog on those lands other than what the Fish and Wildlife Service decides to give it, which is virtually none. So on federal lands, they're protected, but then we have protected lands that are non-federal. And so the objective we were trying to reach there is to retain, first of all, retain state management authority over the non-federal lands. I mean, we've got to succeed in managing the prairie dog, because if we don't, we'll probably lose this authority. It'd end up going back to the federal government. So we wanted to apply a number of conservation measures to make sure we can successfully deal with the problems that are created by prairie dogs on private land and make sure at the same time that we're recovering the species on protected lands and federal lands. So one is we wanted to continue to partner with the recovery implementation team and local governments to coordinate translocations and all of those sorts of activities, cooperate with federal agencies, that includes BLM, Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service. BLM and Forest Service lands right now have where the bulk of the translocation communities that are being developed for prairie dogs, that's where they occur, and so coordination is essential there. We need to acquire more protected habitats. We need to establish state funding for management, monitor translocation sites, manage diseases, support research projects, and continue to do all the things that are essential to recovering the prairie dog. The other objective is to try to increase populations on federal and protected lands. So we've got to identify and establish new translocation sites, translocate, obviously, prairie dogs from non-federal lands to either federal or protected lands, and continue to support this program and develop a multi-year translocation plan. Now, there are a few key provisions in the rule that don't show up in the plan, and this presentation really is dealing with both the plan and the rule. There are things in the plan that aren't in the rule, since it's more dealing about management issues. The rule's dealing with the regulations regarding the take of prairie dogs. So I'll quickly go through some of the things that I haven't mentioned that are in the rule. So first is prairie dogs can't be taken on federal land you know, except as authorized by the Fish and Wildlife Service, since they're protected under the Endangered Species Act. Prairie dogs can be taken when found within inhabited structures on non-federal lands. So there's a open one. If you got a prairie dog in your house, your business, your hotel room, you can deal with it immediately, as long as it's the individual that's actually dealing with it. You can't hire somebody to come in and deal with it. Permit may be issued to a city or county law enforcement authority to authorize take for prairie dogs that are causing public health, safety, and welfare issues within cities and towns within the county. So it's not anywhere in the county. It's only within the municipal boundaries. And then prairie dogs may only be taken by landowners, the lessee, immediate family members, employees on regular payroll and not hired for the purpose of taking prairie dogs, or approved designees. Now, you can have up to two designees, but they have to apply for a certificate of registration and meet certain qualifications. What we don't want having is landowners recruiting folks from northern Utah to come down and have prairie dog hunts on their property. We want to try to keep this as controlled as possible and make sure that we don't overrun the headlights and lose more prairie dogs than we anticipated. Prairie dogs can be removed using any means permitted by state, local, or federal law. Now, just so you know, poisons and toxicants are all regulated by the Environmental Protection Agency, and right now they do not allow the use of any toxicant or fumigant on Utah prairie dogs. And so federal law prohibits that. An individual cannot capture or attempt to capture a prairie dog alive, or possess it alive, or move it alive. We don't want folks moving prairie dogs to their neighbor's yard and just having to deal with the problem again. Prairie dogs cannot be taken on protected lands. So if it's under some type of contractual agreement that keeps that land protected for prairie dogs, they cannot be taken there. And then also we had to amend two different rules. One is the non-game mammals rule. This is where all the Utah prairie dog provisions used to be found. So we've struck all of those out because we've created a new chapter now, R657-70. That's where all of them occur. So this was simply just a housekeeping issue of taking what was there in the non-game mammals rule and putting it over into this new rule. And then also we changed the classification on Utah prairie dogs and what we call our collection, importation, and transportation rule. This is a rule that allows the division to authorize a person to capture, kill, possess, transport, import an animal species that is not otherwise already covered by some rule that authorizes its take. So prairie dogs were classified under this rule as prohibited, meaning the only way the person could get a certificate of registration under this rule for it is to get a variance from the Wildlife Board, which is fairly time-consuming and costly. So this rule has been amended to reclassify the prairie dog as controlled for lethal take, and then it remains prohibited for live capture, possession, or importation. The reason being is that we just wanted to have a little bit more authority because controlled species, the division can authorize take. And that concludes the presentation. That's a lot of information, and hopefully it makes some sense, but I'd be happy to answer questions.
Okay, thank you. We'll begin with questions from the public. Council, questions?
Yeah, I got a couple questions.
There's a question? If you have a question, can you use the microphone, please?
Having been involved with agriculture, we've got problems because you are involved with Obama, because you want to take over everything. The Constitution doesn't give him nor
can you
that privilege.
Sir, do you have a question? We're at the question point right now in the proceeding.
Okay.
You want a name
what
too, John.
Value? Emotionally, I see that things should be protected, life should be protected, but is there Is there a value, or is it just protection?
Why are we having laws protecting the Utah prairie dog?
Yes.
Here's the basic reason is the court decision that gave Utah authority to manage the prairie dog is on appeal to the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals.
You say it didn't?
It is on appeal.
Oh, okay.
To the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals. It's my feeling or my opinion that if the state really stumbled over itself and didn't protect the prairie dog, the chances of winning that appeal would go down quite a bit. So our effort is to try to relieve the problems that property owners were experiencing to as much as we could without compromising the population of prairie dogs and its existence as a species. And so it's a twofold thing, but if we were just to kind of let everybody take them out, I am afraid it would fall back to federal authority pretty quick. And
I'm with you there.
There's nothing we can do about it, and nobody likes wildlife when it's managed by the federal government. Well, I shouldn't say that.
Sir, could we get your name for the record? It's a recorded meeting.
Darwin Bingham.
Okay. Thank you.
If the federal comes in, they are prairie dogs.
No, I should say is, I speak for myself, we prefer states to manage wildlife. That's probably the better response.
I understand. I appreciate that.
Thank you. Any other questions from the public? Council? Jim?
So, if a rezone takes place, then that changes the, or potentially changes the status of the land, correct?
It could. If you're talking about developable land.
Yes, exactly.
If it was agriculture gets rezoned as commercial industrial, then it puts it into the category of developable. And when somebody goes to want to develop that land, they have to notify the division, get the property surveyed, and then have a chance to remove those prairie dogs through trapping before they proceed. But the object is not to put impediments that would really delay the development project unless the proponent is willing to agree to it.
But still, it makes it somewhat of a dynamic or potentially dynamic map situation.
Yeah. The folks, the biologists down there in the southern region looking at this are not seeing or feeling we're going to see a large amount of transition from agricultural lands to developable lands in the near future. And they say this will be managed and evaluated every year to see how it's working, how many prairie dogs are being taken, how many were successfully getting translocated and surviving on the protected lands. And if we're seeing that things are looking a little dicey in terms of how many prairie dogs we got on protected lands versus how many are being taken on the non-protected, we'll have to make adjustments.
Okay. And what's the procedure for the division to capture them? How do they do it? Just like have a heart traps?
Yes. I've never seen them, but I assume they're just live traps that they'll go out and set and try to capture as many as they can and then move them to areas.
They're not going to bring in the big vacuum trucks like they do in Colorado.
Suck them out of their burrows?
Yeah, they do that in Colorado.
Yeah, no, I'm not aware that we've ever used one.
No, they're pretty cool. Anyway, the other question was, you mentioned something about $600,000, and then I don't think you, at least maybe I missed it, but that $600,000, where is it going to come from, and will it be totally administered by the division? It seems to me like going through the intricacies of this law, you've already spent probably that much.
No, the $600,000, it's an appropriation that Senator Vickers is seeking right now in the session. I don't know that it's been appropriated yet, but we're hopeful that it will be. And that would be money appropriated to the Division of Wildlife Resources that will allow us to hire additional technicians to help trap and relocate prairie dogs, to do counts and all of the monitoring that's required. And then also to help fund this voluntary compensation program. We are really hopeful that a lot of these landowners that are experiencing the chronic problems of prairie dogs year after year and have the most on them will find that appealing. And instead of just going in and killing the prairie dogs they're allowed to kill, they'll allow us to trap some of those, which it's a better process. So that's where we're hoping the money can be, where it'll be spent, and hoping we get it.
And who knows?
Nobody can guess that.
I can say there's a good chance, because this is an issue about maintaining state authority where federal authority once was, and I think that's a fairly sympathetic subject with the legislature. So I remain fairly confident we'll get, if not all of it, most of it.
R. Jeffrey.
First of all, I'd like to take exception to what you said at the start, that we got the short end of the straw. I think they sent the big guns here tonight, is what they, I think we got.
Yeah, you're a tough group, and the audience, too.
I have a question. So a judge was persuaded to give this a Commerce Clause exemption, right?
Well, it's not an exemption. It was just a matter of the court found that the Congress, in enacting the Endangered Species Act as it would be applied to the Utah Prairie Dog, had no constitutional authority to do it. And Commerce Clause is the federal power that has been traditionally used to justify Endangered Species Act. But here, there was no evidence of interstate commerce or anything that implicated interstate commerce, and so Judge Benson held no authority at the federal government level to manage the prairie dog.
Okay, so I wanted to clear that up, because it seems to me like if a judge could say that a prairie dog doesn't have any interstate commerce in the past or future, could they also use that same line of thinking to do the same thing for like another species, like a sage grouse or a turtle or something like that? I mean, is this a way that we can go through it and start taking species after species after species off of it because they don't have interstate commerce value?
So primitive. They don't have internet. Yeah. Yes. First of all, just so you know, 70% of all listed species reported by the Fish and Wildlife Service occur in a single state and have no interstate connection. So this is a big deal to the Fish and Wildlife Service. However, this decision is at a district court level. It has no precedential value on any other court, meaning the courts don't have to follow it. They might be persuaded by the court's reasoning, but they're not obliged to follow it. Even if a case came to another judge within the Federal District of Utah, they wouldn't have to follow Judge Benson's decision. So it's fairly harmless in one sense at this, you know, level. But the service is concerned that other courts might find the reasoning appealing, and I think they've appealed it, but they've got a big decision to make, because as it is, the decision doesn't impact them too much. If they take it to the 10th Circuit and lose it, then the 10th Circuit's about 10 or 11 states, and that would become precedential law for every federal district court in those states. So they have appealed the case. We're still waiting to see whether they're going to vigorously pursue it, you know, because it's a little bit of a dice roll for them. As, you know, it's the way it is. How harmful is it as a district court decision versus how confident are we that we're going to win on appeal?
Okay, one last follow-up on that. Is this whole program predicated on the assumption that this ruling will stand? And if it doesn't stand, does the whole thing go out the window and you start over?
It all goes back to, yeah, if we are unable to win on appeal at the federal 10th Circuit Court of Appeals, then it will go back to the Fish and Wildlife Service and we'll go back to where we were prior to November 5th. The other thing we're really trying to be careful right now is the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has the ability to request a stay, meaning that they want the decision to be kind of held in abeyance so that they retain authority while the appeal is pending. They have not requested that yet because part of the things, they have to show a few things in order to get a stay. One of them is irreparable damage. And I think as long as we can manage the species responsibly, they cannot show irreparable damage. And so that's another real strong incentive we've had to try to be careful, you know, and to help property owners as much as we can, but don't get to the point that we create an argument of irreparable damage for the service, for them to seek a stay or request a stay, and we lose our authority in a matter of months. The appeal, you know, probably won't be resolved for another 18 or more months. So we've got a couple of years, you know, to try to go through this and show that we can manage the species responsibly.
Chris.
What constitutes a human health, safety, and welfare hazard, and who gets to decide if one exists for a landowner or the landholder to be able to remove prairie dogs without any sort of a COR or permit?
What that's going to end up being is if you're in an area that's developed for human use, So in other words, you're around homes, businesses, parks, golf courses, airports, any of those things that have been developed for human use. It's a pretty much a presumptive health, safety, welfare issue.
In other words, if the animal is there, mm-hmm. within 50 feet of the structure or whatever, you know, the conflict is,
it can be removed.
Then it's assumed to be a hazard.
Or if it's, you know, in an area, like in a developed area, like I say, if it's downtown Panguitch in the courthouse yard, you know, grounds, it's going to be considered a health, safety, welfare. You know, whether it's really going to bite in somebody or whether the fleas are going to hop off it and spread plague to humans, we can't prove that, but it'll be presumptively considered that. Now, that seems pretty aggressive on its face, but what you need to understand is probably less than 15% of the prairie dog's range-wide population occurs on those lands. So where it's really found when it's on private lands is on agricultural lands. There's prairie dogs in cities, but it's not their population centers that are really the critical things for their survival.
Russ.
Yeah, just to follow up on that health and safety and welfare one, though, you mentioned that they could not hire someone to come and do that. So if you're a homeowner or you know, a business owner, you couldn't hire a professional like you would a raccoon or a skunk mm-hmm. or something like that. Is that because you're planning on getting those people that will be available to go out and trap and move those?
Well, it's twofold. I mean, one, let me make sure it was clear on one exception to that. If it's in your home, your business, you know, a structure inside of it where people live, anybody, you know, that's within that structure can move it, can remove it. Now, if it's in a yard or playground or anything else, it has to be the landowner or the lessee. And even the lessee has to get permission from the landowner to take it. It can be immediate family members. The reason we did that is, again, what we don't want to do is we want to give landowners the ability to help deal with it, but not create a system where folks come down from other counties for prairie dog hunts, you know, and all of a sudden we become much more efficient at removing prairie dogs in these areas. It's really kind of a control mechanism, because there will only be a certain level of ability with many of these folks to deal with it. Now, if you're in a city, you can always call the county sheriff or a city police officer, if they've got certificates of registration, to come and help you with it. You can also call the division that could come and help you with it. In cities, it's going to be kind of tough, because most cities you can't shoot a gun or bow and arrow, and you can't use poisons because EPA regulations prohibit it. So there's going to be pretty limited in, you know, how you could remove that prairie dog. But again, hopefully those are going to be control mechanisms so that we just don't have too many prairie dogs taken, you know, in 1 year.
Well, thank you, Marty. Yeah, I guess what came to my mind is some 85-year-old widow that had no means to deal with it, no knowledge or anything.
Division, you know, would deal with it.
Okay.
They've all got to call and notify us. So one is the division can verify they are actually in an area that would qualify, you know, for health, safety, and welfare. And two is to offer the opportunity to trap. If, you know, if it's one prairie dog and it's 50 miles away, we may say, you know, go ahead and take it yourself. But the goal will be is to try to trap as many as we can, as many as we have resources to do.
Any other questions? Yeah, John.
I have two or three questions. This one graph that shows the adult count, there's a dramatic drop off in like 90, 91.
Yes.
Was that like when 22 shells were available?
It's when you could buy a brick for 10 bucks?
Yeah.
No.
Is that a plague?
What it was more indicative of the fact that we did not have very good counts that year. We didn't get out and count a lot. Now, that's what I'm told from the biologists. That was not necessarily a population crash. There may have been a decline, but the severity of that drop was mostly attributable to the fact that we weren't out counting. And I don't know why that occurred, but that year didn't have many people out counting prairie dogs. So if we don't count them, we only indicate what we counted.
Okay. What?
Oh, okay. Did you hear that? There was a change in personnel probably down the southern region. There was a vacancy.
But they were declared as endangered in 73, right?
Yes.
So is it the state's responsibility to count them when the feds are...
Well, here's how it kind of works. When a species listed, the federal government doesn't do near as much on active management. You know, they provide the law enforcement, they provide the oversight, you know, and telling states how it can be managed. But states do a lot of the work. But they do it under the direction and supervision of the Fish and Wildlife Service. So it's in our interest to do counts because counts enable us to get incidental take permits. You know, so while it was listed under the Endangered Species Act, that was the mechanism for getting some ability for private landowners to control populations. So there was, I say, a strong state interest in trying to do counts and facilitate these things because it was to our benefit.
So what's the penalty if you kill a prairie dog?
Right now, it's a Class B misdemeanor. Pardon? Class B misdemeanor.
There's no reward?
Yeah, a reward permit? No.
No.
I'm not aware of any rewards for it. It's a Class B, which means it could be, I think that's a $750 fine and up to 9 months in jail. Not that many people ever go to jail for Class B misdemeanors, but.
Okay. Do you have an estimate of what it's going to cost to trap one of these little suckers?
I don't. I think the Division has a pretty good idea because we've been doing it for quite a while. And so this will continue what we have been doing, and then with the additional funding, hopefully be able to hire some new people that we can increase the number of animals that are being trapped and relocated.
Okay. We talked about the cost of relocating deer off of Antelope Island, and it was like ridiculous. I wondered if prairie dogs are going to be...
No, it's no more. It's nowhere near as expensive as moving a deer.
I mean, the sheep versus cows is what? 8-1? Maybe prairie dogs is 100-1? I don't know.
But, no, it's as I understand it, we'll go set a number of live traps and then come and check them as they capture them, move them, take them out. And so it's not like handling a deer and trying to move it.
It just concerns me personally that we're creating a big bureaucracy in my opinion, nothingness. But
hopefully we'll see translocations. As we successfully move prairie dogs to protected lands and establish populations there, the number of prairie dogs on the private land should be decreasing. And so, we're hopeful that year after year we'll be doing less and less trapping because the year before we'd already moved a big number of them over and then we're building populations on these protected lands.
The only other comment I had was the compensation, landowner compensation. They estimate a prairie dog eats 3/4 of a pound of alfalfa a day. I did some math, and I don't know how many prairie dogs you would have on a parcel, but if you had 100, they would be eating approximately a ton of hay a month. A ton of hay, if you figured $150, and then it says that they generously provided a 10% mm-hmm. bonus to that for damage to equipment, so that gives you another $15 for a swather knife that costs you $300. So, it's insane.
Wasn't it $50 a dog?
$45 a dog. And I'm trying to remember what...
Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Maybe the easier way to handle this is the Division met with a number of the property owners that were having the biggest problems historically with prairie dogs mm-hmm. and presented this formula and everything, and they all thought that would be a great program, and they supported it. So in terms of is it enough compensation, the landowners they consulted with felt it was.
Yeah. I know for deer depredation, it's quite a mathematical process to go through to compensate for hay losses, and then the funding is always used up before the...
This is a little bit different program in that we'll basically strike in agreements with landowners at the beginning of a season saying, here's how many dogs we counted, here's how much compensation you're going to get, and in exchange for that, you're not going to kill any prairie dogs from now and through September 30th. While we trap, or at least until we're done trapping. And so it's kind of an amount that's agreed to up front as opposed to just letting claims come in like we do with big game. Every year they vary depending on how bad winters are and how much hay is. And, and at times we exceed the appropriation we have for it, which then folks got to get prorated. This will be a little different because it's all handled at the front end as opposed to the end and seeing whether you got enough money to cover all the claims.
And that money is going to come out of the 600.
Yes.
So if the legislature doesn't appropriate that, what are we going to do?
We won't have a compensation program. It'll just be.
Well, I don't have any on my property, so I guess if those landowners are okay with that, why that's.
Let's hope not. There was nothing part of this at the historic range up here.
Yeah, I hope not.
Any other questions from the council? Paul.
Marty, I have a question. We have the title on this document as far as the prairie dog management on non-federal lands, and yet. On page 15, we have a federal lands section within it. And so it seems to me that we should probably relabel that to refer to protected non-federal lands.
Well, the federal lands section isn't dealing with managing prairie dogs on those lands because the state doesn't have authority to do it. It's really dealing with coordinating with the federal government and federal land managers to try to translocate prairie dogs. So it's really going to be an interesting thing because we'll take a prairie dog and, you know, on 2 feet on the state side of a federal land, it's going to be under state authority. And the second you step onto federal land, it'll be threatened under the Endangered Species Act. So we couldn't even take prairie dogs onto federal land without their cooperation because we'd be in possession of a listed species without a COR or without their authorization. So I think that section is trying to deal with is the level of cooperation we're going to have to develop with these federal partners in order to make this thing succeed. Because that's where a lot of the translocation areas are on federal lands.
It just seems to me like, given what is stated in there as the objective, it really doesn't match the title. But that's a personal issue there. The other question I had is more a philosophical question. Do you feel like, given that the state with this plan seems to be emphasizing remove everything from private or non-protected lands onto federal or protected lands as a conservation approach. Is that correct? Mm-hmm. Is that what I'm seeing here?
Yeah. No. I mean, where there's probably the least amount of tolerance for prairie dogs are in cities and homes and, you know, developed areas. And when we look there, they don't have any future there anyway. We're never going to recover prairie dogs based on living in people's backyards, and it's not where we want to go. But the agriculture lands is where we do have quite a few, a high percentage of the population. And the idea is to move those off, but under the ag lands, there's a graduated scale that it's done, you know, gradually based on how many prairie dogs we now have on protected land. The more we have on protected land, the more we can take off private land. And so that's the idea. That's where probably 60% of the range-wide population occurs on private agriculture and rangelands.
Yeah, I guess I just look and find myself concerned if we were to apply this to other species that we're trying to recover. If we basically say, you know, we're not going to consider the private land, but that's more of a comment than a question.
So well, it is different because if you look under the Endangered Species Act, I mean, they look at every individual is protected.
Sure.
Yeah. It doesn't matter if it's in your backyard, if it's a wolf in your backyard, it's still protected. And, I mean, it's very limited in what you can do with that. And I think that's one of the shortfalls of the Endangered Species Act is that it just doesn't allow much flexibility in dealing with species that you're trying to recover. And while populations may be pretty good, you still can't deal with them where they're causing a lot of problems. And so our thought with this is that we can do that with state authority, and we can move these prairie dogs, we can deal with these problems and provide a better mechanism for it. And the landowners that participated in this, the counties, the, you know, there was a whole array of folks that this was kind of the plan, the objective that everybody thought they could live with. And it's one the division feels confident that we can actually recover the species still.
Okay, thank you.
One more question,
John.
So what do you have any kind of a timeline for Or is there such a thing as saying this prairie dog is recovered to the point where we can delist it totally?
Well, first of all, we don't need to delist because it's not listed. So all we're doing right now is conserving the species. We're just trying to make sure we don't see precipitous population declines to the point that we lose them. So we're trying to conserve the species, and the way the plan works is there's the three recovery units, but once a recovery unit gets a three-year average of 2,000 adult prairie dogs in the recovery unit, then all the regulations on take on private lands are removed. So in other words, we've reached recovery objective. Now, consider the Fish and Wildlife Service said when we have 1,000 prairie dogs on each recovery unit, it'll be considered recovered. So the state plan actually provides for twice that number before we remove all restrictions on property owners to deal with prairie dogs on their private lands. But at that point, I say we should have populations of 2,000 in each recovery unit.
And then this program will go away?
We'll continue to manage the prairie dog, but I imagine the involvement of the state will become less
at that point. I guess, you know, a lot of people in the ag community are gun-shy because didn't they say, you know, when we had 350 pair of mating wolves that they would be delisted, and they're still not, so.
Yeah. Well, that's why we like wildlife managed by the state, because, the Endangered Species Act does some great things. It does preserve animals, but it's pretty rigid, and in some instances it can create real problems that, because of its rigidity, that this can't, and wolves are a perfect example. You know, we have many times more the recovery objectives on wolves, but we still can't get them delisted.
Right. Art Jeffrey.
One last question, and it's really quick. I'm asking a biological question probably to the Assistant Attorney General, but...
It's okay. I answer biological questions.
All right.
Is that all right?
Okay, I've got this pain.
I'm back. I'm getting backed up over here. So.
The idea is to eventually get these things moved over onto protected lands, I assume. So with that in mind, what are the survival rates of these transplanted animals, and is that a viable plan?
Okay, mortality on translocations is about 80%, which seems really bad, but overwinter survival is 70% mortality. So the species loses a lot every year. That's just part of its, you know, biological regime. But translocations, we do lose some. But as we've got better at creating prefabricated tunnel systems and burrows, you know, so that we just don't go throw them out in a patch of sagebrush on federal land and say, you know, start burrowing. That did not work well at all. But since we've started creating these burrow systems that they have some place to immediately have refuge and cover from predators and other things, the mortality from attributable translocation has gone down quite a bit. So we're confident, you know, that we can move enough prairie dogs and keep enough alive that it will be effective.
Yeah, I'm sorry. This is the last one, I think. So the surviving ones, do they go into the counts that are put together of the ones that are taken?
Counts are done each spring. And so if there was translocations through, you know, the summer, fall, and then we go into winter, and the next spring we count, what they'll count are prairie dogs seen above ground. Then they'll multiply that by 2 to try to determine, you know, how many adults there are, and then they'll do the formula for trying to calculate productivity. So yeah, we'll figure it out. I mean, you're going to see, you know, you put a X number of adult prairie dogs into a new colony, 100 of them, and next spring you count
20,
and you know there's 40 of them, so we may have lost 60.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay, we'll move on to the comment period.
Was that, the guys back there, am I accurate enough on that? Okay.
We'll move on to the comment period for the public. Is there any public comment? Okay, council. Comment and or motions. R. Jeffrey.
I'll make a comment. I want to just say that I do think this is an admirable goal to try to protect some of the private property rights, but also try to save this population that is threatened, and that's got to count for something. I do think so. I have troubles with the thoughts that it just appears to be a way to rid an animal from developable lands, which it seems to me can go on and on from species to species as long as you find a sympathetic judge somewhere. I worry about that. It kind of rubs me wrong, but I like the idea that the goal is worthy. But I do worry about that. I worry that they can find a sympathetic judge and hit another species and another species and another species just because it doesn't fall under a certain thing. It's just my comment.
Well, I mean, as far as how we deal with developable lands, that's the divisions. I mean, that's our choice. Now, I too get concerned that if this model kind of gets applied to big game or something else, it could create some big problems. But I'm fairly confident. We're dealing with such a unique situation here with the prairie dog. Deer don't burrow in your backyard, you know, burrow under your driveway and things like that. They're pretty easy to push off. And I think generally people have more tolerance for a deer in their backyard than a prairie dog, or at least I'm just judging that off my experience of hearing people in southern Utah, how they feel about prairie dogs versus, say, elsewhere in the state about deer or elk. So I think we're pretty safe there. It's not going to be a court that would ever push us to do that. It would more likely come through the legislature.
Any other comments? John?
I'd like to make a motion that we accept the rule as proposed.
Second.
Second.
Okay. Did you get that, Jody?
Can I make one comment?
John Leonard made the motion, and it was seconded by James Gaskell, I think.
Can I make just one comment? There are two things really we need to vote on. One's the management plan. The other is the rule, and the other two rules that were amended.
So right. So we're working on
just
the,
on the plan.
On the plan right now.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Okay. Any comments on the motion? Okay. We'll call a vote. So all in favor of the motion?
Aye.
And it's unanimous. Okay. Next, then, let's take the rule, and we'll take R657-70, and I assume that you've already presented everything you needed to do on that one.
I have.
Okay. Any questions from the public regarding that rule? Council? Comments from the public? Council?
I'd like to make a motion that we accept the first rule as presented.
Okay.
The rule.
If we want, John, we could probably do them both together.
That's fine. I'll do both rules. Yeah. That's fine.
Okay.
There's actually three.
It's all three rules.
All three.
Do you want me to give the numbers? So just it's rule R657-70, taking Utah prairie dogs. It's R657-19, taking non-game mammals. And R657-3, collection, importation, transportation, and possession of animals.
Okay.
You remember all that?
John, can you restate your motion then?
I would move that we accept the three rules.
As presented.
As listed.
Okay.
And as presented.
Okay. A second by Jim Gaskell. Okay. Any question or comment on the motion? Okay. All in favor? Paul has a question.
Yeah, one question. As we talk about the definition for federal lands, I'm wondering why we try to list all the different agencies versus just lands managed by the United States. Mitigation Commission lands.
I think if I put it, I think it says including, and so that would mean not exhaustive, okay, but mostly by way of example. So I tried to hit the major lands that in southern Utah we're probably going to deal with.
I hadn't caught that. Okay. Thanks, Marty.
Okay, so we'll call for the vote. So all in favor of the motion?
Aye.
It's unanimous. Okay. All right, so I think that is everything for this evening. And I had one announcement that Robert wanted me to remind everyone about the upcoming aquatics informational meeting, and hopefully you had received email information about that, and It's really encouraged that everybody participate if you can. So, all right. So
when do we have to RSVP?
Do you know when we have to RSVP?
The 10th. Yeah, by the 10th.
The 10th?
Yeah. But she's taking them now.
Okay.
Move to adjourn.
All right. Second. Everybody in favor? Meeting is adjourned.
Before 8 o'clock.
I'm opposed.